Our message really does begin here in verse 14 of chapter 5. And one of the most egregious examples of pride in all the scripture, Haman is absolutely consumed, not only with himself, but with the downfall of Mordecai the Jew. In fact, we read in chapter 5 last Sunday that Haman can't stop talking about Mordecai. The very sight of him fills Haman with the deepest sense of rage and anger, even among the good things, the quote-unquote blessings that Haman may be living with. The very thought that Mordecai still remains alive and breathing is a very agitation to his soul. So Haman's wife, Zeresh, says, as we just read, build gallows that stand 70 feet tall in the air and hang Mordecai on the gallows. Then go into this banquet that Esther has prepared for you and the king and never worry about Mordecai again. Well, as we saw here, Haman loved the idea. Pleased him, verse 14 says. And so he instructed that the gallows be made. That's where we left off last Sunday. And as this story unfolds, it takes yet another turn. Will Esther's request for the Jewish people to be delivered from Haman's edict come too late? After all, Haman's plan is to kill Mordecai before the banquet ever begins. And it's at the banquet that Esther is intending to request of King Ahasuerus the deliverance of the Jewish people that as of right now, Ahasuerus has no idea that Esther is included along with Mordecai. That's where we left off. What's going to happen? Well, write down number one there in your notes, a sleepless night. A sleepless night. This is not sleepless in Seattle. This is sleepless in Shushan, all right? Sleepless in Shushan. Now, the theme of our study in Esther is God's providence. And once again, we see the sovereign hand of God invisibly at work. In fact, the very first statement here in verse number one is beyond any planning of human ingenuity. In other words, Esther nor Mordecai could have planned what's happening here. Look at it, verse 1. On that night could not the king sleep. What night? Well, the night before Esther's big request. But the night before Mordecai, unbeknownst to anyone besides Haman and his friends, is to be hung on the gallows. The night before the banquet. And for all intents and purposes, Haman is asleep, Esther is asleep, Mordecai is asleep, but not so with the king. The king can't sleep. And notice what Ahasuerus does to occupy his sleeplessness. Verse number one says that he commanded his servants to bring the book of records of the Chronicles, and they were to read it before the king. I think that would probably indeed help you go to sleep if you had to read the King's Chronicles. That's what he's asking for. I need something to put me to sleep. And so he goes and he commands the servants to go and grab the King's Chronicles. Well, of all the volumes, think about this, of all the volumes of Chronicles that the servants could have grabbed off the shelf, it just so happens that the servants pulled down the volume that contained a familiar story to us. We read about it in verse number 2, and it was found written that Mordecai had told of Big Thana, which is a funny name to me. I wonder if he had a little brother called Little Thana. Big Thana and Teresh, two of the king's chamberlains, the keepers of the door who sought to lay hand on King Ahasuerus. Do you remember the story? I don't have time to take you back there, but you'll find it in chapter 2 in verses 21 through 23. You have to read this for yourself if you've not been with us in this journey through Esther. But suffice it to say this morning that this assassination plot was contrived by Big Thana and Teresh, and they desired to kill King Ahasuerus. Well, Mordecai heard about it. He overheard the plot. And Mordecai went into Queen Esther and said, Esther, I just want to let you know, Big Thana and Teresh, they're wanting to chop the king's head off. You should probably tell those who are guarding him so that he will be aware. And that's exactly what happened. And that's what they're reading about. Mordecai's name gets recorded in the king's chronicles for being responsible for saving his life. But in verse number 3, Ahasuerus asks a question. Look at it there. And the king said, "What honor and dignity hath been done to Mordecai for this?" By the way, he's asking this question 5 years later. We've just been reading the story over a period of a few weeks. But from the moment Mordecai, who at the time worked in the king's gate and overheard this assassination plot, informed Esther, and Esther protected the king, that happened 5 years ago. Now you fast forward 5 years, the king can't sleep. He's trying to stay awake. We would turn on the television. We would do something. He says, "Go get me the king's chronicles." And they pull down the volume that just happens to have this story in it that occurred 5 years ago. By the way, we already know that Mordecai was overlooked for that. And he says, "Well, what? Remind me. Well, what did we do for Mordecai?" And the reason he's asking is because it was very customary for the Persian kings to honor loyalty in a very public manner. Because if they honored loyalty in a public manner, right or wrong, it would encourage more loyalty among their subjects. So this was a major oversight that 5 years ago, we read, look at verse 3, the king's servant said, "We did nothing." We did nothing. You mean we didn't do anything for Mordecai? We didn't praise him. We didn't parade him. You're telling me we did nothing? Nothing. We did nothing. And now all of a sudden, this sleepless night turns into divine providence. Because the king now knows that something must be done in Mordecai's honor. And that's what he will set out to do, howbeit 5 years late. I want you to listen to me very carefully. God's timing is always perfect. For had Mordecai received this honor 5 years earlier, then there would have not been perhaps this opportunity to save his life. But God knew what was best by delaying the recognition for 5 years. For the Lord planned, even before Mordecai was ever born, that on the eve of Mordecai's planned murder, a plot Mordecai knew nothing about, that the king would have a sleepless night that would result in Mordecai's safety. On that night, of all nights, yeah, the night the gallows are being built, the night the decree has been made, the night before Esther's ever told the king anything that's going on, that night, of all nights, he can't sleep. Of all things, he wants to read a book. Of all books, it's his very own chronicles. Of all chronicles, it's the story that contains Mordecai. And of all questions, what did we do for him? Nothing. Oh, well, that's going to change. How did we overlook it? We got to do something for it. I read that and I'm reminded that God is never in a hurry. 5 years has passed. Delayed recognition, but yet God is not in a hurry. And his delays are not always his denials. His timing is always perfect. And in case you're still unsure about God's providence in all things, look what happens next. Write down number 2 there in your notes. Not only a sleepless night, but secondly, a deflated ego. A deflated ego. Look at verse 4 and 5. And the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman was come into the outward court of the king's house to speak unto the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's servant said unto him, "Behold, Haman standeth in the court." And the king said, "Bring him in." So get this. Right on the heels of verse number 3, Haman's standing in the court. You know what that means? Haman went to work kind of early that day. No doubt because he is excitedly in a hurry to hang Mordecai. And the only thing that he needed was a king's approval. Then as he could go out and do his business and return back for Esther's banquet. I don't know what Haman's typical routine was. And perhaps he liked to get up and have some toast with some grape jelly and a side of fruit punch and a cup of coffee. Took his time before heading out the door. Banana, maybe, every other day. That's what I like. Maybe that's what Haman liked. But maybe this day he said, forget the toast and the banana and the coffee. Just give me the juice. I got to get to work. We got to get some things done. And so he gets there early. In fact, nothing's ever recorded about his whereas even going to sleep. Well, this is quite early in the morning. But before Haman could even ask the king permission to hang Mordecai, the king had something to ask Haman. Now look at it in verse number 6. This is beautiful. So Haman comes in, and the king said unto him, maybe it was something like this. Haman walks in. Hey, king, sorry to be here so early. I have a question. Hey, hold your question for a minute. I want to ask you a question first, and then we'll get to yours. Okay, yes, sir. You're the king. Here's the question. What shall be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor? You gotta love this. All Ahasuerus does is ask Haman, how should we honor the man? It doesn't say Mordecai. It doesn't say Haman. He doesn't say anybody. How should we honor the man whom I have delighted in? You know what else is fascinating to me about the providence of God is that both men came in to work that day with Mordecai on their mind, but neither one of them realized it about the other. Ahasuerus has Mordecai on his mind. How did that happen? The providence of God. Haman has Mordecai on his mind. How does that happen? The providence of God. And this is where it gets really good. Look at the last of verse 6. Now, Haman thought in his heart, well, who else would the king delight to do honor more than moi? Me? Haman thinks the king's talking about him. Who else? And so what Haman does is he purposes the recognition in such a way that he would want to be honored. Mordecai's not said anything. Haman's not said anything. The king's not identified. Haman, what would you do to the man that I want to honor more than anybody else? Oh, he's probably talking about me. Oh, here's what I would really like to have. After all, Haman, deep down inside, wanted the throne more than anything else, and you see that in his request. Look at verse 7, and Haman answered the king, for the man whom the king delighted to honor, let the royal apparel be brought, which the king uses to wear. The horse that the king rideth upon, the crown royal, which is set upon his head, and let this apparel and horse be delivered to the hand of the one of the king's most noble princes. And they will array the man with all whom the king delighteth to honor and bring him on horseback throughout the streets of the city and proclaim out loud before everybody, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delighteth to honor. I think that's what we ought to do, king. Are you following this? He wants the king's robes, the king's horse, the king's crown. He wants the king's princes to parade the one being honored through the streets of the city. Oh, and that's not all. As we read in verse 9, Haman suggests that when the man is being paraded throughout the city, the princes need to cry out over and over again for all the people to hear, this is the man whom the king delighteth to honor. Here he is. That's what you ought to do, king. The next verse, verse 10. I see this playing out in slow motion. I mean, just envision the scene with each phrase, Haman's countenance gets brighter and brighter. Look at it in verse 10. Then the king said to Haman, hurry. Huh? That's Haman, right? Make haste. Huh? He's going to really do this. Yeah. Take the apparel. Yeah. Grab the horse. Yeah. Haman, everything you've said, go out and do it, yeah, for Mordecai. This is how that's playing out, right? imagine the look on Haman's face. Oh, and one more thing, look what he says. Let nothing fail of all that you have spoken. Everything you plan, do it to Mordecai. King has no idea. But God does. Providence of God. Haman's proud heart was his stunning demise. And now we have a dramatic change of events. look at verse number 11. Then took Haman the apparel and the horse. He had to. He was going to dive it in. He took the apparel, the horse, arrayed Mordecai, brought him on horseback through the streets of the city, and proclaimed before him, "Thus shall it be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor." Oh, I love just thinking about this. Vengeance, right? Retribution. I mean, this guy has sent out a decree in the whole land to kill your whole people group because of you. He don't like you. And now, through the providence of God, everything that you planned for yourself is now going to be used for somebody else. Oh, not just anybody else, your enemy. The guy you hate. The one that you want to kill. And guess who gets to hold the rope of the horse? Haman. What would you do if you're a Mordecai? Let me tell you what I would do if I was a Mordecai. I'm sitting in there. I'm wearing the king's crown. I got the robes on. We got his horse and everything's good. And Haman's down there. And Haman's saying, "This is the king whom the man whom the king delighted to honor." Mordecai said, "Hey, can you say that again? I like hearing that. Can you say that a little bit loud? This is the man whom the king delighted to honor." One more time, Haman. One more time. "This is the man whom the king delighted to honor." Oh, man. That's what he does throughout all the streets of the city. Verse 12, Mordecai returns to his position in the king's court. Haman's ego is totally deflated. In fact, verse 12 tells us that he runs home covering his head in shame. Look at it. Then Mordecai came again to the king's gate, but Haman hasted to his house mourning, having his head covered. It's a picture of shame, right? It's like when you see on television, someone gets arrested and they're very embarrassed and shamed, and all the media and the cameras is high profile. Well, they do. They'll cover their heads, or they'll take their coat, or they'll hide their face. They're just shamed. They don't want to be seen because of what they've done. This is not shame in repentance. He's not embarrassed by what he's done. He's embarrassed because he just had to parade throughout the whole city carrying his enemy on a horse, saying that this is the man the king loves, inferringly, more than me. And then he tells his wife and friends everything, verse 13. Haman told Zeresh, his wife, and all of his friends everything that had befallen him. Then said his wise men and Zeresh, and his wife unto him, and let me paraphrase this. Here's what they said. You're in trouble. You're in trouble. Don't you think for a single moment that if this is what's going on in the king's mind, that you'll survive this. But the cat's not out of the bag yet. At least for now, because look what happens in verse 14. And while they were yet talking, who's talking? That's Haman with his wife and his friends, and he's telling them everything that happened to that day. I don't know if you've heard about it. I've had to parade Mordecai throughout the whole city while y'all been working on the gallows. I mean, this is the worst day of my life. And now his friends, who just said a day prior, "Hey, we're tired of you talking about Mordecai. Why don't you build 70-foot-tall gallows and just kill them and be on with your life?" Now they look at him, they got a different tune. "You're in trouble." I wonder if Haman's saying, "Well, you could have told me that yesterday." Everything's changing now. And then all this is happening, verse 14, the king's chamberlains hasted to bring Haman unto the banquet that Esther had prepared. The king knows nothing. Esther knows nothing. Haman doesn't know the whole story. Let's get on with the banquet. Write down number 3, not only a sleepless night, a deflated ego, but you write down a courageous queen. Courageous queen. Chapter 7. So Haman has had a bad morning, right? It's only going to get worse. Look at verse number 1. So the king and Haman came to the banquet with Esther the queen. And the king said again unto Esther on the second day at the banquet of the wine, "What is thy petition, Queen Esther? And it shall be granted thee. What is thy request? And it shall be performed even to the half of the kingdom." This is the third time that Ahasuerus has offered to give the queen anything she wants. And now it's time for her to courageously, but still cautiously tell the king what's going on. That's what happens in verse 3. Then Esther, the queen, answered and said, "If I have found favor in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me. Let my life," that's very important, "let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request." So here we are. It's what we've been waiting on now for a couple of weeks in our study. Took three parties. She finally gets it out. And for the first time, she identifies herself publicly as a Jew. Remember, her whole life, Mordecai said, "Don't do that, conceal it." And then when the edict goes out, Mordecai didn't mind to tell everybody he was a Jew because I'm going to die. And then he tells Esther, "Esther, you need to tell them that you're a Jew or you're going to die." You know the story. I'm not going to re-preach it. It all fits within God's sovereignty in the mind of Esther. She goes in and finally says, "My life is at stake. My people along with me are going to die." Verse 4, "We are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, to perish." She goes on to say in verse 4 of chapter 7, "Had we just been sold as slaves, as Ahasuerus, I would have kept my peace. I would have kept quiet. I wouldn't have said anything. But my life has been sentenced to death." She's using her words carefully. You notice it? She's including herself. Not just an edict has been put out about a people. No, "My life, king, has been sentenced to die, me and my people." She's showing the king that it's not just a group of people that have been decreed to die, but his queen, his wife has been decreed to die. And notice the king's response. Verse 5, should be the response of any husband. "Then the king, Ahasuerus, answered and said unto Esther the queen, 'Who is he? Where is he that did presume in his heart to do so?'" Who is he and where is he? Let's not forget who's in the room, by the way. Haman's in the room. He's watching this. He's listening to this. His bad morning just turned into a terrible day. I should have entitled the sermon, "Haman and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day." It's exactly what this is. Now look at it in verse number 6. "And Esther said," who is it? "Well, it's the adversary and the enemy." I love what she's doing here. Carefully, cautiously using her words. She's not just saying it's Haman. No, she's saying it's the adversary, the one who hates us, the one who wants to condemn us, the enemy to us, that wicked Haman. Of course, he's standing there. So it says, "Then Haman was afraid before the king and the queen." And in verse number 7, the king storms out into the garden in anger, and the king, arising from the banquet of wine in his wrath, went into the palace garden. Don't mistake the king stepping out into the garden for apathy regarding the matter. If you don't look into this carefully, then you'll misunderstand what he's doing. The picture is Esther's over here, Haman and Ahasuerus are sitting at the table together. They're having a good time and Esther's banquet prepared for them. Esther comes over. The king says, "Hey, this is it. What is it? Anything you want, I'll give it to you." "Well, here's the deal. I have been decreed to die. My people have been decreed to die in anger. Who has done this?" This guy sitting over here. "That man's done it. The adversary, the enemy, the wicked Haman. This is all him." He doesn't just push away from his table. "All right, let me just go take a little walk for a minute. You know, walk it off." No. What? He pushes back the table and in anger runs to the garden. Now why? Well, the king is angry because a lot of things is unfolding before him for the very first time in this moment. Now think about his night. He realized he had not recognized Mordecai for saving his life. On top of that, he finds out that the one who did save his life was a Jew. He just learned as well for the first time that his queen is a Jew, all of which is compounded when he discovers that his favorite person in the entire kingdom, Haman, is the one who conspired a plot in deception to kill the very people who've been looking out for his life. Oh, and by the way, the king's insignia is on the decree. Now, this is not good for him politically, as it appears to the people, that he's now decreed his own wife's death. You know why he's running out of the garden? He can't just kill him when his name was on the insignia. He's got to figure out how he's going to get out of this one. And while the king's in the garden discerning all that is happening, Haman makes his decision to stay inside and plead for his life. Look at the rest of verse number 7. And Haman stood up to make request for his life to Esther the queen, for he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king. By the way, it was against the law to be alone with any woman of the king's harem, but especially the queen. Haman's perspective, however, what choice did he have? He's scrambling to save his life, but that is exactly all that the king needed to get his own life out of this predicament. It's for Haman, instead of going with him, to stay in the room alone with his wife. That leads me to the last part of this section, right down number 4. You probably got it figured out. A dead man. A dead man. The king needs a reason to condemn Haman, because the decree alone bore also the signature of the king. So to kill Haman for the decree would condemn his own life also. So upon returning from the garden, Haman gives Ahasuerus a reason, albeit with a little fabrication. Look at verse number 8. Then the king returned out of the palace garden into the palace of the banquet of wine, and Haman was fallen upon the bed whereon Esther was. A bed is just a bad choice of word usage there. It was more like a couch. Haman was fallen upon the bed wherein Esther was. Then said the king, will he force the queen also before me in the king's house? And the word went out of the king's mouth. They covered Haman's face. So here again, we see this enemy of the Jews falling down before a Jew. And don't misunderstand verse 8. Haman wasn't really attempting to abuse the queen, but as long as it looked like it was the case, that's all King Ahasuerus needed to put him to death. So the real picture is this. The king's out in the garden. Haman chose to stay in. He's fallen on his knees before the couch where the queen is sitting. Please, I'm so sorry. He's begging for his life. So when he walks back in and sees Haman begging for his life along with the queen in the room, he's like, oh, that's all I needed. Are you going to force my wife? Are you going to abuse my wife? Are you going to make sexual advances on her? Oh, let's kill the man. Let's kill him. He's taking advantage of my wife. So, that's all the king needed, even if it was a fabrication. Now look at verse number 9. They go and they cover Haman's face, and Harbona, one of the chamberlains, said before the king, behold, also the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman had made for Mordecai, who had spoken good for the king, standeth in the house of Haman. Now this is just another great irony in the story. I mean, Ahasuerus has everything he needs to condemn the man to death without even considering the decree. The decree is no longer in the picture because the king's insignia is on it. We'll deal with that later. You'll have to come next week to figure that one out. But right now, it was about killing the man who put him in this position. So he fabricates the situation, and they put a bag over his head because this man is going to die. And while they put the bag over his head, Harbona, one of the servants of the king, says, oh, by the way, king, I don't know if you know about it or not, but in the middle of the night, this is the same guy who's been building 70-foot-tall gallows in his backyard for Mordecai, the guy that saved your life? Well, they couldn't see the look on Haman's face because there was a bag over his head. But I imagine he muttered something like this: "Thanks for that deeply helpful comment, Harbona." And that's all the king needed. For the king's response was, look at it. Verse 9. Great. Hang him on his own gallows. That's what he says. Hang him there. Look at verse 10. So they hung Haman on the gallows that he prepared for Mordecai. Then was the king's wrath pacified. Read verse 10 carefully. So they hung Haman on the gallows that he prepared for Mordecai. From the parade to the gallows, in more ways than one, Haman became a victim of his own invention. You got to look that up sometime. Google it. How many inventors died from their own inventions? The inventor of the parachute died on his first try. It's a shame. There's a host of stories out there. That's exactly what's happening right here. A victim of his own invention. Do you reckon Haman's parents ever said to themselves, "I sure hope my boy grows up to be successful, you know, get a good education, get the right situations"? Who knows? Who knows? Maybe, just maybe, he'll even work in the king's palace one day. Well, he did. Look what that got him. You see, Mom and Dad, I'm not so sure that it's success that we should hope our children attain. I'm trying to parent three kids right now, and it's all I can do to get them to eat their vegetables. It's really all I can do to get them to love God with all their heart, soul, and mind. Do you have aspirations and dreams? Sure. Maybe one day my kid would be the president. And if they are, you better move. But that's really not what I want. I want my children to love God with all their heart, with all their soul, with all their might. Because if they love God with all their heart, soul, and mind, it makes no difference whether they find success in a palace or success in a factory. The problem wasn't Haman's position. The problem was Haman's heart. Not only did he not love God, he hated God's people. You know, this is a really good scene in respect to the story. The villain is gone. Perhaps you came to church this morning excited. This is a great day. This is the day that Haman gets hung. But the danger is not over. God's people are still decreed to die. And the question is, how is this all going to end? I want to close by giving you two things to think about. They're not in your notes, but I would like for you to write them down. Because in this text, there is a warning from Haman, and there is a reminder from Mordecai and Esther. If you're to write these things down in your note, you might write down, first of all, the warning. And here's the warning. The warning is this. Are you listening? Self-centered thinking will eventually bring you shame. That's the warning. Self-centered thinking will eventually bring you shame. Haman's pride was his demise. Not Mordecai. Not Esther. Not Ahasuerus. Not his wife. Not his friends. Haman's pride was his demise. All he could think about was himself. Self-idolatry was his god. And it was that same self-centeredness that forced him to shamefully parade the man he hated through the streets. It was that self-centeredness that forced him to desperately for his life fall before the very Jews that he once demanded fall before him. Self-centeredness was what caused him to disgracefully die on the gallows he made for someone else. This, friend, is the law of the harvest. Live for yourself, then of yourself you will die. It'll always come back to get you. One day, your self-centeredness will bring you down. When are you going to deny yourself? When are you going to stop living for me? Oh, you turn your nose up at the little gods that people make out of wood and stone. Those are the most dangerous. The most dangerous is the God that lives in your heart. You, me. Self-centered thinking will always bring you shame. It's just a matter of time. Just a matter of time. Perhaps my wife and I are not so more burdened at this moment in our juncture in parenting than with this concept. I'm trying to help our kids think about others and not be so selfish. I don't want to raise narcissists. I don't want my kids to turn out to be so prideful, always putting themselves before others, that it turns out into their lifestyles. Because if they are raised in my home, always thinking about themselves, then one day there'll be a day that shame will tear them away from God. We're so burdened about that. Even before coming to church this morning and working with one of our own, it was a matter of having to remind them of how much God hates selfishness. And he hates it in you too. That's the warning. Let me give you the reminder and we're done. The reminder through Mordecai and Esther is this. Write this down. God is at work in every detail of my life. God is at work in every detail of my life. The details. The details. Don't just say, God is at work in my life. No. It's much more than that. God is at work in the details of your life. The details. Think about the details of God's timing and as where is the sleepless night. The details of delaying Mordecai's recognition. The details of picking the chronicle that included his story. The details of not unveiling to Haman who he wanted to honor. The details of the banquet. The details of Esther. The details of the gallows. I could go on and on and on. But we must be reminded this morning, there's not a detail of our life that God is not at work in. He's at work in the details. Question is, will I trust him? Will I rest in his providential care of my life? I just want to read to you the last statement I wrote in my notes. Please don't pack up. Just listen. You can either become like Mordecai, a victor through God's divine intervention, a victor through God's divine intervention, or you can become like Haman, a victim of your own prideful inventions. The difference? Well, it's found in whether or not you'll yield yourself to God's counsel and to humbly submit to his purposes. Because if you don't, it'll be the figurative gallows in which you will hang one day, having only wished I had trusted God.